Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Hello, this is Stephen O'Doherty. Every parent knows that when their children have good relationships at school, with students and with teachers, they're not only happier, but they do better. Well, a school is a complex organisation, but what if there was a way to describe and measure what good relationships look like? Well, now there is such a tool, and research in the UK has validated the link between a healthy network of relationships and better academic and social outcomes. The Relational Schools Project uses a specially developed survey to measure the proximity of relationships in schools. In the UK, the Relational Schools Project is helping to drive school improvement, and now they've brought the tool here for a large project with Christian Schools Australia. The director of the Relational Schools Project is Dr. Rob Lowe.
If you go back to Genesis 1:26-28, you see there the plurality of God. You know, he creates a man.
In our image, he
says. In our image, our likeness. And so therefore, I believe we're meant to reflect that plurality.
In John 1, Jesus was with God in the beginning.
Absolutely right.
So God is a community, three in one.
Absolutely. And I think we find it hardwired in our genetic makeup. We know more now than we've ever done from the field of social neuroscience about the way our brains affect our bodies and vice versa. So we know now from several studies around the world that the quality of our relationships is able to turn off and on our gene responses to certain cancers. We know that dementia rates in the over 50s, particularly men, is lower in those groups of men who have known connected relationships. We know that when you get relationships right between young people, it impacts their health, their happiness, their well-being, a rightly popular word in educational discourse at the moment, and their capacity to learn, particularly their reasoning capacity, particularly their memory. And that shouldn't be a surprise to teachers listening, because we know that learning isn't a kind of individual brain cognitive thing. It's mutual and it's deeply social. So the job of the Schools Foundation was to go back to the beginning and understand the real context for how schooling should be done.
There are lots of ways of measuring well-being, but I rather think this is probably the first time a strong set of data has been collected about the quality of relationships, and you've got a particular way of doing that. How does your research work?
So we ask them across five dimensions of a relationship. So we say relationships are really healthy when students have bags and bags of face-to-face communication, not mediated by a third party like technology. We say that there needs to be some sort of sense of shared story, a sense of where that relationship has come from, a projection of where that relationship's going. We say that relationships are really strong when there are many strands to that relationship, strands of knowledge, how much you know about somebody, the range of contexts you've met them in, where there is a feeling of equality in the relationship, a sense that power has been distributed fairly, that you can be on an equal playing level. And even with the teacher-student dyad, you know, if you've, although it's asymmetrical in nature, the best teachers are the ones who make students feel they're on a level playing field with them. And lastly, they've got to have shared values and goals, common purpose, and that's got to be shared effectively.
So, Rob, your personal research has actually shown that these relationships that contain these particular qualities lead to better academic and social outcomes in schools?
Yeah, that's right. So we measured relationships in a range of school contexts, urban, city, rural environments, big schools, little schools. But we were drawn to schools that had publicly available data that would suggest they were different. So they had attendance rates that were higher. They had bullying rates that were lower. They had academic achievement differentials that were narrower, so less tail, as you might say in Australia. That is, children from those disadvantaged contexts achieving academic scores from the most material advantaged homes.
And that is the problem in Australian education and around the world. The kids from good homes in good schools are going to do well, but that's not everyone, and we just don't seem, we call it an equity issue. It is an equity issue.
Yeah.
How do we get the same achievement for other kids? Have you found through your research the magic bullet?
International research suggests that parental interest in education, that's not engagement with school, that's engagement with your own child, is still the strongest determiner irrespective of socioeconomic circumstances, whether a child's going to do well at school or not. So that's about making your kid a cup of tea when they get home and asking them how the school day was. Even if they grunt back and give you nothing, perceptions of support are really, really important. So the question is, if you're going to a school, if you go to a school, but you don't come from a home like that, where your home life is perhaps fractured or non-intact, where you're coming from real difficulties, our research shows that if school can become like home, like household, with people who love and care you, and you feel those relationships, you connect with at least one adult and one peer around you, then what you can start to do is disconfirm some of those very difficult histories you've come from.
And disconfirm, thrive. That's a great word, disconfirm.
Disconfirm, that's right, and start to thrive as if you came from a home like that in the first place.
So does that mean that you can reverse engineer a school that's not working well for all of the children? You can go in and build, based on your relational principles, mechanisms within the school culture that will make those, that will make it better for those kids, and they'll achieve more. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So the most relational school we saw in the UK, despite the fact that it had 1,600 students in it, had broken that environment down into three schools within the school, had family groups or pastoral tutor groups, as we call them, of no more than 1 to 15, sometimes 1 to 13. Interestingly, had a range of staff involved in pastoral tutoring in a school, so not just teachers, but receptionists, bursars, often people who were lovely motherly or fatherly figures who were really good at mentoring young people. They did all their enrichment in the middle of the day, not the end of it. So, you know, not if your parent tells you to go and be in a choir or go and play some sport, they'll come and pick you up. They had everybody doing that in the middle of the day to build relationships in a deeper, richer way. And it was those schools where we saw that achievement differential disappear. We saw bullying levels in decline as children got older, whereas in other school contexts, we saw bullying levels increase as children got older, more likely to bully each other, particularly if they were girls, and online. That started to disappear in the more relational school. We saw external agencies anxious to get children into that school. So if you were fostered or came from a context of social care, that's the place, that's the kind of school environment where those agencies said, these children will settle the most quickly. These are the kids where attendance was higher. This is where they were happier. That is different.
If I'm a teacher, what should I be doing then? What
culture? Well, let's just go back to the root of what pedagogy is. Pedagogy is one of the most misused, abused words in teaching, to my mind, because it has been used and abused as the science of teaching, and it isn't. If you go back to the Greek, pedagogues were people, and they were distinctive from teachers of the day. They were employed separately to teachers to walk alongside young people. You recognize that in Deuteronomy 5, where education happens, roadside, bedside. Those people would walk alongside those young people, helping them grow spiritually, morally, culturally. It's 21st century that has put those roles together so that we are potentially, in some contexts, not all, for teachers listening, more interested in disciplines or subjects or subject knowledge.
Yes.
But great teachers are the ones who have great subject mastery and know how to build rich relationships with young people.
Yes, one says I teach maths, the other says I teach children.
Yeah. Yes, and sometimes the one who says maths might be extremely good at it, have a really good degree, but hate young people. And when I was an assistant head of a school, it was very obvious those teachers who didn't like being in classrooms of young people.
So how does it translate to the classroom? What does your research say to you will work for a teacher who wants to develop a better relationship with the kids in her class and get to the stage where the classroom is a harmonious and productive place?
When I left my last but one school, I remember my last meeting with my mentor, and I said to him, you know, I'm about to take on the sort of job that you do. What's your advice to me? And he said to me, well, you know what? You're going to have, for the first time, your own shiny office by yourself. And he said, my advice to you is never be in there ever. Be on the corridors, go and find a student, steal their crisps, if only to promote some banter between you, go and stand in the lunch queue, go and be in the back of people's classrooms, go and get to know them, and quickly, because it'll be the base that you build from. I knew this in the classroom as well. My wife was intensely frustrated by the amount of time I'd spent in front of a computer looking at UK soccer scores, couldn't really understand given that I'm a rugby fan, why I'd be interested in whether Everton or Leighton Orient had won on the weekend. And it's because I never ever found myself in a conversation with a young person or wanted to, where I couldn't immediately go and talk to them about the things that they were really interested in.
Right.
So if a student came in, I would be able to say, difficult weekend for Liverpool, wasn't it? And be able to talk about which team was out, who scored, you know, likely outcome of that result, where they were now on the table, and hope, and actually this was the case, that then they would meet me where my interests lay, and which happened to be something like Shakespeare.
This is one of your relational principles, which is knowing people in multiple contexts. And there's a lovely story that turned up in one of your research projects about a class where half the girls did not get on well with the teacher and were not achieving, and the other half did. Now, clearly, you know, something's going on there. What did you find when you shone your relational microscope on that?
Remembering that this member of staff are volunteer for this study, and the school had put her up for it as well because they felt, quite rightly, that she built wonderful relationships with young people, which she did. And in some of the classes we measured, those relationships were exceptional relationships. In one particular class, she had got to know a number of these students in these different sorts of contexts. So she had coached them outside of class for netball and hockey, and at the weekend played on a local hockey team where some of these students would appear again in a mixed adult youth side.
Right.
So for half her class, every week, she didn't teach them once a week, for half that class, she saw them 3, 4, 5 times a week. And in these different contexts where they'd won things together, lost things together, experienced pain, frustration, they got to know each other very well. You imagine coming back every week to that class where she saw them once a week. With half the class, that relationship had not moved on. And so instead, those students started to feel resentful. They thought the others were, in their words, favourites. When she started to put people into groups, totally unconsciously started to make choices about who would lead, who would be showing, demonstrating best practice. Mm. It wasn't until we held up the data about her class to see it that she then understood how that class had actually fragmented and split. She described the process of going through that and rebuilding relationships with the other half of the class as the most powerful professional development experience she'd ever had.
You used to get sent, and in 98% of schools around the world, this is the same, as the assistant head, the deputy, you were sent the naughty kids who'd failed in the, you know, to get on with the class activity. Tell me about that.
I was on call, so I had a radio, and I was summoned to go and, you know, get little Jack out of a classroom because he'd misbehaved again. And head of English had come to me. Jack can no longer be in English classroom. He needs to come with you, Mr. Lay. So there was a table in my room, and Jack had come and sit down, and Jack would invariably tell me about his day or perhaps how bad his previous evening had been at home. And I started to build a really deeper, richer relationship with Jack. And what wouldn't happen is that the teacher would rebuild that relationship because the system of exclusion didn't promote that. So when Jack went back to English next lesson, invariably he was gone within 3 minutes. In fact, you could set your watch to it. You could you could go and collect Jack before you were called. Because it's expensive to provide cover to that teacher so they could come and sit with me and we could start and think about ways that Jack and teacher A could get on.
And you understood this because your own experience of school wasn't very positive.
No, it wasn't. And I had a very difficult experience of peer group relationships as a child that led to, you know, a real sort of fork in the road moment for me. But my school responded brilliantly and performed what I call now a bit of a skin graft and put me from a set of destructive, difficult, negative relationships into a context of new caring relationships. Yes. Where people were looking out for me, teachers who really cared, loving parents who looked after me and looked out for me.
Yes.
And from that, I then started to do much better at school and ended up doing really well at university.
Well, from an Australian context, the really great news is that you've been working now since last year with Christian Schools Australia. And just as a disclosure, we got together when I was the head of CSA and we started to talk about how your work in the UK might actually help Christian schools in Australia to understand more about the very thing that we should be doing the most. If we're Christian schools, the argument goes, we should be very relational. You ought to be able to validate that with research, and you ought to be seeing the results of that work flowing through to better outcomes for kids. This year, you'll do 15 data collections in schools. That's going to be, I believe, the largest project that the Relational Schools Foundation has ever done.
Yeah.
But last year, the pilot program revealed something really interesting. Tell me about that.
So we measured relationships in a school north of Sydney, and we were measuring exactly that. We were looking at the culture and climate of the school as determined by relationships between young people. And we found relationships in that school were as strong as the most relational school we'd seen in the UK, which was from a public, non-private, and secular context. That was extremely exciting to us to see the quality of relationships between these young people in this school.
Now it turns into full research, 15 plus schools. What is Christian Schools Australia hoping to achieve now by working with you this year?
Part of our work is to try and hold a mirror up to CSA and ask them whether they're truly living out the values and ethos that they say they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's appropriate that we do that because we know from John 13:35, I think, that, you know, when Jesus talks about a new commandment, which I always think is quite strange because he's talked about love thy neighbour before.
Mm.
So I always wonder why it's a new commandment. I think the answer to that is that he says that we should love each other as he has loved us. And that's a reminder to me that that is a real relationship of acceptance and forgiveness. And so we're holding up that door, we're holding up that mirror because Jesus says to his disciples that people should know that they are his disciples by their love for one another. That's how they'll know. So if a school says that they're a Christian school, then the people within it should be able to visibly demonstrate the love and care for one another. And so our job is to go and hold that mirror up empirically to a school and say, let's look at the relationships between your students, between the staff and your students. We're also measuring relationships between parents and the school to understand the ways in which the school, in certain contexts, is really connecting with its community and the community around the school, to both celebrate where it's going really well and be able to offer advice and guidance of where we think it's going less well.
It's really important work, and I do know that ACARA is interested because last year we took you to meet the head of ACARA, Rob Randall.
Indeed.
And we're hoping that just as in the UK, where the government has become interested in your research and in what you're doing, that Australian authorities will likewise. One of the members of CSA that you've been working with now for a while is called Alta One. Now, Alta One is an alternative type of schooling for kids who've been voluntarily or otherwise removed from other school settings, the type of kids that just don't get on and don't fit in. Alta One has schools in Queensland and also in Western Australia. You've applied your relational matrix to Alta One. What results did you get?
We measured relationships between teachers and students and chaplains and students. And we were really surprised at what we found. I mean, you understand that these young people are out of school because, for the most part, I'd say almost in 100% of cases, they've really struggled to form relationships either with their peer group or particularly with staff members. Mm. So there is nothing to suggest that these young people, merely by moving school context, should be able to just build these relationships effectively and quickly.
And many of them come from disadvantaged home backgrounds. And Dave Stevens, our great friend who runs Alta One, says that in most cases, it's usually a lack of fatherhood.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sure that in many cases that we've experienced, it's that non-intact, fractured home life that is one of those underlying causes of their of struggles.
So you had a look at that. They've moved to a different school. That's the only variable that's changed in their life, if you
yes,
like.
Yes, that's right.
Your research comes in. What did it find?
It found relationships between staff and students that were the strongest, the most powerful, the most nurturing relationships we'd seen anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world?
Anywhere in the world. You know, we published a book in 2015 and a documentary film called The Relational Teacher, and that, to some extent, was self-selecting because, again, we went to find examples of amazing relational pedagogy.
Yes.
So You know, it's in the context of that sample that we saw these extraordinary relationships, both between teaching staff and non-teaching staff. And that's also an important point. You know, it wasn't the academic discipline that had made these relationships what they were. These were people who had learned how to connect with very broken, difficult young people.
Well, this, once again, this is a Christian organisation that is showing the way. And I know that in Western Australia, for instance, the government there is very interested in Dave's model, and it's part of a group they call Care Schools.
Yes.
And ought to be adopted elsewhere around Australia.
Indeed.
And is it surprising to you then as a Christian, Rob, perhaps to go back to where we started the interview, is it surprising to know that if God made us for a relationship, and you come in as a social scientist, an educator, a pedagogue, whatever you want to call yourself,
yeah,
you measure these things, do you see the fingerprint of God in your data sets?
I definitely do, in the sense that, I mean, to go back to my own personal story, my experience of sin entering the world, whether this is the definition of sin or the result of sin, is broken relationships. It's enmity, it's blame. So what we know in that switch between Genesis 2 and 3, where God was walking with man in the cool of the day, was close, known. Mm. Suddenly, by the time you get to Genesis 3, people are hiding from each other and hiding from God. Mm. They want to be in isolation and separation. That was my experience of being in school. I felt extreme isolation and loneliness. And I know lots of people will have dealt with that. And so it shouldn't be a surprise that the solution is also it has God's fingerprint in it as well. And that is Jesus on the cross experiencing ultimate separation on our behalf, looks up to the sky at the end and says, my God, you know, where are you? What, you know, why have you forsaken me?
Yes.
It's that moment of utter anguish because he is alone at that moment, not as perhaps some of the classical painters having with people all around him, but just by himself. And he does that to bring us back into relationship. And so therefore, it most certainly, I think, is the answer to some of the really difficult things we see in the world.
Rob Lowe, thank you.
Thank you very much.